the Johnson Wax Program, bringing you the voice of Don Nesbitt and the Passing Parade. John Nesbitt, one of the nation's foremost tellers of tales, the news is no matter of cold statistics and technical information, but a thrilling collection of the true stories of the world's rich men, poor men, beggarmen, and thieves. Which here, as in his famed series of MGM pictures, he gathers together as the Passing Parade. These dramatic footnotes to A Summer of Destiny are presented by the makers of Johnson's Wax, Johnson's Self-Polishing Glow Coat, Carnu Auto Polish, and special finishes for many war products. And here is John Nesbitt.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, for the night of July 13th, 1943, and another story hunt through the news events of this Summer of Destiny. In bravely predicting last Tuesday night that the world would shake within 14 days with the news of one great Allied blow after another, like commentators everywhere, I was nonetheless caught completely short by the landing on Sicily. Yet as day after day of the amazing communiques that flashed across the ocean to us at home, some have tried to be doubtful, conservative, a little cynical about this news. But with the fall of Syracuse, one mighty step on the road to the Straits of Messina, followed today by Augusta, it became humanly impossible to avoid a cry of joy. For it has so far been overlooked by the commentators that in making our landing, not at the expected places on the south of the island, which would have been easiest, but sweeping around to the east coast far up toward the north, our leaders did perform a piece of strategy which will go down in history. By this move, they took advantage of the very thing we feared most, the prodigious mountains of Sicily. And they turned it into a trump card, for they placed the mountains between our fighting men and the bulk of the defending enemy. If the man responsible for that magnificent piece of daring and dangerous strategy is Eisenhower, it becomes apparent that when a supreme commander is finally selected in Europe, that commander is more than ever likely to be an American, and his name will be Eisenhower. One picture lying over the map of that two-mile-wide strait that is our goal, Messina. A picture of the stretch of water which is one of the most dreaded places in the world. It is the scorpion of the Mediterranean Sea. And that is why the ancient Greeks believed that on one rock in the strait there lived a terrible monster who yelped like a dog, who had 12 clawing feet and 6 necks of enormous length. Each neck fitted out with a head with 3 rows of fangs in it. With these heads, it clutched ships and sent them beneath the waves. Today, that same channel of water is again a place of horror for the actors. Where once the many-headed monster lived, now come the many-headed fighter planes of the Allies, reaching out to destroy all craft which attempt to negotiate these waters to reinforce the Axis troops. Then there are the people of Sicily, 3.5 million of them or more, a dark, hard, lawless people, passionate in love and hate. They're treacherous, they're mercenary, and they're courageous. Their home conquered again and again, these dark people are in themselves unconquerable. There in the shadow of the volcano Etna, where our men will soon be moving into the final battle, hide the secret societies of the Mafia. From this society of murderers came the Black Hands that terrorized America. And from the Black Hands came the gangster bands of Al Capone and Lucky Luciano. Every one of Al Capone's 13 bodyguards was a Sicilian, and a vast majority of the Italian descendants, whose machine guns roared through our cities in the days of the bootleg wars, came first from this beautiful, treacherous island for which the fight goes on tonight. Final Sicilian picture from a storyteller's notebook must go back to a day 300 years before Christ walked in Nazareth. Then as now, the port of Syracuse was the locked gate that any invader must first open before he could be master of Sicily. At that time, there lived in Syracuse a man who was the Einstein of his day, a genius of mathematics named Archimedes. When the invader came, Archimedes invented one of the world's first death rays, through which he was able to throw a hot beam out to invading ships and set them afire. So Syracuse took exactly 3 years to conquer. 23 centuries later, on Monday, July 12th, the city fell to Montgomery in 3 hours. Now to move on with the parade to another part of the world. Not long ago, a song swept through the German army. It was called the Song of the Young Century, and its melody we're hearing now for perhaps the first time here in America. We have suspected for some time that there was a story hidden behind this melancholy air. And here it is at last. Do you remember from the last war the hymn of hate? It is one of the things that undoubtedly cost Germany the last World War. Yet the Prussians, still running things there, have actually repeated that error all over again. The hymn of hate was Ernst Lietzauer's song that went, "We will never forgo our hate. We have all but a single hate. We love as one, we hate as one. We have one foe and one alone, England." By 1918, the common German soldiers, who'd been made to sing that so many times, had begun to hate not us, but the song itself. And at last they hated the Prussian officers who fought it up. And not long ago, Ernst Lietzauer, who wrote the hymn of hate, ended up as a half-mad, broken-hearted man. He wandered around Nazi Germany looking for a friend, finding everywhere only disgust and enmity. It killed its maker, too, the once famous hymn of hate. Yet never good at learning the lessons of the human heart, the present military rulers of the Germans set to work with a whole gang of songwriters and tried to turn out a batch of fresh hymns of hate for this war. As you recall, the Nazis thought up first the one called Sailing Against England, and their military band puffed away at it with might and main. Farewell, for we sail against England. Our flag be it waved from the mast, of Germany's strength it speaks. We are going to halt at last the Englishman's sneering laugh. Today it is verboten in many regiments, because so many disgruntled German privates have begun singing not the approved words, but still sailing against England, only backwards. They had the same trouble over there with a hit song in Berlin last year, which was made at the time that Marshal Rommel was smashing the Allies back across the desert. It was called Rummeling Along in Africa. Just as everybody in Berlin began singing it, Rommel stopped rummeling along, got pushed right back on his heels, and began to run like the devil toward Tunis. And there died a German hit song. Still, the Prussians can't get it into their heads that singing is a thing you do with your heart. And no song of hate has ever lasted. But all the time that the German armies have been dying in Russia, scalded everywhere inside their iron walls, many a simple soldier, just as he did in 1918, is beginning to remember the beautiful heart song with which he grew up, the tender one his mother sang to him when he was a child. Then as he grew older, the exquisite love songs he heard from his first girl. But these are too unwarlike.
Don't sing that decadent nonsense. Sing like men. Sing hate. Sing marches. Sing of the honor of death. Sing of cuts and rotten throats. Sing of nation history for the next 1,000 years!
And so it has gone. Yet today, modern Nazi regiment after regiment has begun to sing another song. This new one, now the overwhelming favorite of the plain German soldiers, has nothing to do with victory.
It actually has to do with deceit, with sadness, with longing for peace. And the words of it go, in front of the barracks, before the heavy gate, there stood a lamppost. And if it's standing yet, then we shall meet there once again. Beside the lamppost in the rain. The lamppost knows your footsteps, so lovely and so free. For you it burns unceasing, but it has forgotten me. And if I do not return again, who will stand beside you in the rain? Not sound like a song of hate and vengeance, does it? This sounds like the song of men who are growing tired. Maybe it means nothing, and maybe it is a straw blown on the bitter wind of coming events, but certainly it is the old truth that the Prussians never understand, that you do not set haste to music, but only the best in the human heart. Before we come to the chief story of the evening, after an interlude of music, here is Carlton Cadell, who, while Harla Wilcox enjoys a few weeks' vacation, becomes the representative voice of the Johnson Company. Carlton Cadell.
In talking with one of my dealer friends the other day, I was pleased to hear him say that the big majority of his customers are definitely good sports when he can't supply them with exactly what they want. You might order a quart size of Johnson's wax or self-polishing glow coat, and he might have only pints on hand, or vice versa. Your cooperation in accepting the size he has is really a contribution to the war effort. Both your dealer and the makers of Johnson's wax products are doing the best they can to keep your favorite polishes available in standard sizes. They thank you for your willingness to be a good sport about your purchase. They realize that Johnson's wax is rendering a valuable service in these times, in protecting your floors, furniture, woodwork, and household things, making them last longer and saving you work. And here, Carmen Dragon makes a bright selection from the passing parade of music, Captain Meredith Wilson's Mail Call March. John Nesbitt admits to having an endurable weakness for astonishing stories. Yet, out of one of the country's largest collections of documented reports, he generally manages to have the facts and figures to prove the truth of his yarn. And it is to this kind of a tale he turns the spotlight of the passing parade this evening.
Dawn, the trenches of the Carso sector, called Battle Section Number 144 of the Italian Army, high in the Alps. And the date is February 22nd, 1917. In the trench are 20 human beings who have found themselves in the dead center of hell, of active battle. 18 mud-covered, panting privates, and one lieutenant and one corporal. All of these men are lobbing hand grenades over the trenches just as fast as they can, for a furious assault is being made on their position. They tear the pins out with their teeth, hurl the metal bombs madly off into space. And three positions from where the corporal stands, a man jerks his grenade up to his mouth, wrenches out the firing pin, raises it to throw, at which second a sniper's bullet finds him, hits him straight between the eyes, and the man drops to the bottom of the trench, the sputtering hand grenade clutched tightly in his dead fingers. 3 seconds and the grenade blows up. A series of explosions as the concussion sets off a whole case of grenades. The air fills with hot metal, and at last the whole trench collapses as if a giant earthquake had struck. Later on, the rescue squad digs out that area. There were 20 men, 18 privates, the lieutenant, the corporal. There are now 19 corpses and one dying man. Him they cart back to the hospital, and the surgeons hopelessly work on him. 27 different operations, and yet the man lives to send his name crashing over the earth. Corporal Benito Mussolini. What if he had died? But he didn't die, did he? He lived to destroy his nation, stab France, and in this month of 1943, lie awake in agony as the avenging allies landed on the beaches of his homeland. And the curtain rises now on another. We are in Madras, India, exactly 2 centuries ago this month. Hordes of dark-faced people in flashing costume filling the narrow streets. The native holiday. Tremendous gaiety in spite of heat no white man can survive. And inside an oven-like little office in the headquarters of the British East India Company, a young English clerk, racked with malaria, his brain twisted into melancholia and despair, picks up a loaded pistol. He very carefully sees that it is properly primed and cocked, and then he raises it to his temple. For the bookkeeper, office clerk of the East India Company, sees no future for himself except ledgers, which he loathes.
Support for the streaming of WRVO is made possible thanks to the financial contributions of our members. Support the service you use by making a donation by clicking on the Contribute link. WRVO's live stream will begin momentarily.
Out from his face, his hand begins to shake, but he clenches his teeth, examines the priming carefully again, raises the pistol, and again pulls the trigger. For the second time, a click of the hammer and no explosion. The bookkeeper faintly drops into a chair. A friend comes in. The clerk suddenly speaks to him.
Take this gun, point it out that window. Shoot.
Either use too much malaria or too much heat. But here goes.
Here, let me see that. Just twice I have tried to kill myself with this thing. It would not fire. Maybe destiny has reserved my health a life for something else.
10 years pass. 3,000 British soldiers meet a foe of 50,000 tribesmen. One of the great battles of mankind. The English win, and India becomes a jewel in the crown of the British Empire. And the man who forged that victory was the pale young bookkeeper who closed his ledgers when his suicide failed to become a soldier. His name was Robert Clive. Clive of India. On and on go the pages of history, always sounding this extraordinary fact that nearly every man who has changed the story of mankind has at one time or another been curiously preserved by destiny. Now it is the winter of 1915, a frontline trench, the Merville sector of France. It is very quiet. The shelling has stopped. A plump little colonel of the Fusiliers is using the lull to write a few letters home. An orderly steps into the colonel's dugout, salutes,
and hands him a field telegram. The Corps commander wishes to see the colonel at 4 o'clock. A car will be waiting at the Rue Croix crossroads at 3:15. Cursing splendidly at that commander, the plump colonel gets up and he obeys his orders. Through a mile and a half of deep mud, he wades to get to the Rue Croix road. He arrives and he splatters the air with mud and cuss words at exactly 3:10. There is no car waiting. A half hour passes. No car arrives. Then an hour. The little colonel stands there, the rain pouring down his neck. And at 4:40, a sergeant slogs up the road to that shivering officer. Colonel, the general sends respects. There's been a mistake. Your car was sent to the wrong place, and now it's too late to see the general. He says you'd mind to rejoin your unit. An hour later, the furious, still cursing colonel splashes back into his company trench, and his servant, called a Batman, hurries up to him.
Oh, I've moved your kit to Captain Oliver's dugout, sir. He says he'd be glad to share it.
But why the devil have you moved my stuff out of my own dugout?
Oh, I thought you knew, sir. Just for an hour and a half after you left to see the general, a whiz-bang landed square on your dugout. All that is left is a hole in the ground.
A hole in the ground. The colonel looked at him for a moment and began to roar with wild laughter. And the next afternoon, that corps commander, who had called the colonel out for an appointment that wasn't kept, received a huge case of the finest champagne, on top of which was a neat card from the colonel. Dear General, love and kisses. Signed, Colonel Winston L.S. Churchill. If that accidental invitation had not arrived, if the car had not been misrouted so that he had returned to his dugout a little earlier, then Winston Churchill would never have been alive to guide England during her crucial hour. And during the First World War, an ambulance in France had picked up the body of a young English officer. Finding no life remaining, it had started off toward a cemetery. Arriving there, the two drivers got out and went around to remove the body.
All right. I'll get inside to take hold of it.
Dear God.
What is it?
I thought I saw it
move.
No.
Nevertheless, I don't think I'll ever sleep sound again unless we take it back to the doctor's.
60 minutes later, a physician looks up from an operating table. Yes, he is alive. The hopeless was attempted, an operation followed, and that soldier lived. He lived to hurl the Nazi out of Libya, drive the enemy onto the bayonets of the Americans, and so make possible the invasion of Sicily this week. We know him today as General Sir Bernard L. Montgomery, CB, DSO. And now add to the list a black-haired athlete who dozens of times was sent out on missions that were suicide jobs, who had bombs burst virtually in his hands, who escaped from houses that were shot through with machine gun bullets, who 8 times had a price, placed on his head, who was driven through 100-foot double-long line of men once, who each struck at him with a heavy bar as he passed, who survived every single one of these adventures with such luck that his people named him Man of Steel, and whom the Germans know today as Stalin, leader of the soldiers who stood before Leningrad until the world's greatest try for conquest had become a ruin. And finally, and lest I overlook one of the most extraordinary of these mysterious quirks of destiny that changed the history of the parade, let me come to the strangest of them all. The date now is November 9th, 1923, and we are standing huddled against the side of a building, watching a riot on the broad central square of the city of Munich, the Marienplatz. In the chaos of Central Europe after the war, the Bavarian government faltered and was about to fall. The National Socialist Party of Bavaria decided to seize the reins of power. And now, across the square, they march. In front is an old, stiff-backed man, General Ludendorff. Two standard-bearers are carrying the flags, then new to the world, of the Buck Cross, the swastika. Rank upon rank of shock troops, brown-shirted, proudly stepping forward. It is 8 minutes after 11 o'clock in the morning. The column swings right from the Marienplatz. You enter the Palace of Government. But there, placed across the steps, is a gray line of grim, steel-helmeted police, crouched down behind machine guns. One of the Nazis opens his mouth to speak,
party leader, Adolf Hitler. He throws up an arm, but his screaming words are drowned in a burst of gunfire. And down he goes under a thick hail of bullets. And more of them, and whole rows of brown shirts, until the pavement runs scarlet with blood. One man only holds his march. Straight old Ludendorff. He marches on, alone, until he stands squarely in front of the muzzle of a machine gun. And, of course, the firing stops. The riot has ended. And now the brown shirts count their dead. Adolf Hitler was among the first to fall right in the center of a river of steel bullets. A man named Goering is picked up, badly wounded, but alive. And corpses are carried across the red cobblestone. Then at last they lift the body of the standard bearer, dead, with the great banner of the swastika floating down over him. And they stop. For beneath the body of the standard bearer is party leader Adolf Hitler. Alive. Save for a wrist wrenched in the fall, he is untouched. At the second of fire, the standard bearer had stumbled one pace to the left, and he had received the river of death that was aimed at Adolf Hitler. So he lived, leaving all the world to wonder forever afterward what might have happened if that standard bearer had not stumbled. Why did death spare them, the men of darkness and the men of good, who were locked together in the struggle today? There is no answer. Yet this I know, that if destiny sometimes spares men of enormous evil, it is also always careful to preserve the lives of the men who one day rise up to destroy them. And perhaps there is a young boy fighting in Sicily, utterly unknown to us tonight or to the world, who has been miraculously saved from certain death today somewhere, who will come to learn that destiny saved him because it had something else in store. And such a boy may tower up tomorrow to become one of the hopes of our future, a giant in the passing parade.
Another word from John Nesbitt in just a moment. But first, this summertime note. When bugs and insects smash against the glass windshield of your car, you remove them very soon because they interfere with your vision. They also, of course, smash against the finish of your car. And these should be removed because they might damage that finish by chemical action. Washing may not remove them. It's safer to use Johnson's Car New, the easy-to-use auto polish that both cleans and polishes in one application. Carnu is so easy to use, you'll gladly do the job yourself. It is electro powder. When you wipe off this powder, the finish is sparkling with a mirror-like smoothness, which is less apt to catch dirt. Johnson's Carnu, spelled C-A-R-N-U, is inexpensive. It will enable you to keep your car looking its best.
Join you again next Tuesday evening. It will be, unless, of course, the news of the hour becomes irresistible again, to bring a group of true stories which will be far removed from the war and the people of today. And now, with a bow to Carmen Dragon for his specially composed dramatic music, this is John Nesbitt bidding a very good evening to you all.
This is Carlton Cadell speaking for the makers of Johnson Wax Finishes for Home and Industry, inviting you to be with us again next Tuesday night when we again present John Nesbitt in The Passing Parade.
This program has reached you from Hollywood. This is the National Broadcasting Company.